You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is John Moe. John has served as host of national public radio broadcasts such as Weekend America, Marketplace Tech Report, and from 2010 to 2015, WITS. His reporting has been heard on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Marketplace, Day to Day, and more. His writing appears in humor anthologies, The New York Times Magazine, McSweeney's, and The Seattle Times. He's a much-in-demand public speaker and the author of three books. His latest book is spun out of his popular podcast by the same name. It's called The Hilarious World of Depression. John Moe, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So we do a check-in now. Like, I'm in my bedroom on the northwest side of Chicago. Are you in your closet?
I'm in my closet. it seemed like a really fun and whimsical thing to do, to turn my bedroom closet into an office, or the cloffice, as we started calling it.
Nice.
Because we figured, well, that'd be a fun way to spend the week or two that COVID is going to be with us.
Cut to
3 months later. And I'm realizing, as the author of an acclaimed book about mental illness, that it perhaps wasn't the best idea. But I have the office set up in the front of the, it's a walk-in closet. So I have the office set up in the front. I do my work here, my sound editing. And then here I have a mattress pad.
Yeah, I see it.
A divider held up on a shower rod with ponytail holders. See that?
And then everyone's improvising.
Back here is where I do my recording. So when I was on Fresh Air, I sat back there.
Wow.
And because I'm from Seattle, there's a lot of flannel shirts, which are good at muffling sound.
That is, yeah, I have a recollection of that scene from Brazil, I think it is, where the walls keep coming in, it's like in the office.
You know you've made it in publishing and podcasting when you're based in your own closet. It's really, it's really a good sign.
I guess we should start by talking about depression.
Sure.
All right. So you have a quote in the book, quote, "Depression is formless, colorless, odorless, and doesn't show up on medical imaging. I can't even define it. I've never found anyone who could. That's part of the problem." That's still true for you, right?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, it's this thing that has been with me for decades and then has been part of my work for the last several years. And somebody asked me, well, what is depression? And I was still like, bad thing. And I've read William Styron. I've read Andrew Goldman, like all these amazing authors, highly skilled authors, still can't quite put a tag on it. I mean, I tend to use a lot of metaphors and analogies to kind of illustrate it because it is so invisible. So I'll often portray it as a house, a car, a guy, you know, whatever it is to get a feel for it. But it's basically a thing that, I mean, What I've found recently, even since writing the book, a friend of mine told me, well, you know, major depressive disorder is at heart an insurance term. It's a way of putting a name on something so you could get treatment for it and have that treatment covered. Hmm. But, and some people will call it depression. Some people will call it a darkness, or, you know, Winston Churchill called it a black dog. It's anything that distorts your mood and interferes with your ability to live a complete life in the way you want to, I think.
The metaphor I liked is when you said that you can turn into a human version of a song by the Smiths. I think that, why don't we just replace it with that? I mean, it's long insurance forms, but...
Well, it's, I mean, people often associate it with that kind of sad, mopey, you know, the Morrissey or the Cure. But in my case, I was never much of a fan of either of those bands, and I was never all that sad. Like, I never had the just low, mopey quality of it, and some people do. But I could always get out of bed, and I was never goth, but it just took other forms for me, which really got in the way of me even knowing that I had this condition for a long time.
It's interesting, too, because you've lived in the comedy world, and I'm married to a comedy professor. She runs the first ever BA in comedy writing and performance at Columbia College here in Chicago, and, of course, worked at Second City forever. We are both huge Carol Burnett fans.
God. I kept running into that, especially when we first started the show.
Yeah.
So many Carol Burnett fans, and my whole family, I grew up in a family, my parents were immigrants from Norway, and there was a lot of things going on in the house. There was alcoholism, there was codependency, there was a reluctance born of Norwegian society and American society to not talk about the problems that were going on. But we all agreed on comedy, and we all especially agreed on Carol Burnett. Like, I remember viscerally when it was announced that Tim Conway was going to be on every week from then on.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was joining the cast as a regular, like, oh, life is so good right now. And we would gather around and watch this thing. And then I went out and started interviewing people, you know, Peter Sagal, Andy Richter, Paul F. Tompkins, even younger comedians. Baron Vaughn, know, is very young, but he's like, oh yeah, no, on Nick at Night, they had Carol Burnett reruns, and we all watched that. And I talked with Paul F. Tompkins about it, and about how those people on that show just seemed to love each other.
Yes.
Like the joy of doing comedy together. And part of it was Corman and Conway kind of cracking up.
Breaking. Yeah.
Actually, Conway never broke.
Corman, I mean, that's that we call it doing a Harvey Corman when you do the breaking.
Yeah, you do the cough and the bend down, and it's amazing. And they seem to love each other. Paul F. Tompkins said it's a group you wanted to be with. You wanted to be in that group. You wanted to be in Match Game. You know, you wanted to be where the funny people could enjoy being funny with each other.
I get interviewed over the years about, you know, all the people who come through Second City, and one of my go-to lines is that no one got into comedy because they're well-adjusted. I think that's generally true of the world too, but you know, you write in the book, quote, "Comedy is intoxicating to a young mind in distress." I read that out loud to my wife, and she was like, 1,000%, because you know she gets these. It's a college major, so these kids who like were classic underachievers suddenly find this thing where they're watching Marx Brothers movies and Richard Pryor and learning about vaudeville and Buster Keaton the thing that blows them away the most is Ernie Kovacs.
Really?
They because Kovacs is like contemporary.
Yeah.
Right.
Kovacs sort of was, I mean, everybody, all the people he talked about were aware of the absurdity, but someone like Kovacs had some spite for the absurdity.
Well, yeah, right.
He was kind of pissed off at how absurd things were.
Yeah.
I think people gravitate to it for a lot of, either as observers or as participants, because it does, comedy shines a light on the absurdity that everybody lives with, And it's a sort of truth telling. It's like, no, this is ridiculous how people act in this situation and how people, you know, are romantic in these situations or how people are unhealthy, whatever it is. And they shine that light on it. And then for somebody watching, Richard Pryor, or Gene Wilder, whatever it is, you have that sort of sudden truth being told, and you have the form, which is reassuring in its sameness. So it can be the most novel comedy you've ever seen. You know, for me, like when I was watching Monty Python as a kid, I'm like, what is even going on? Like, this is a whole new planet. But at the same time, there was a premise, a setup, and a punchline and a laugh. And like, okay, I know the rules of this world that I'm in, so I'm going to be safe, and it's going to be okay. And I think that's why, I mean, one of the reasons I think the show has worked and the book has worked in talking to funny people about depression is that those comedians can phrase those things, those truths, in a way that you know, they don't have to come up with a medical definition for depression, you know, or anything else. They'll say the truth that cuts through the fog and hits you in the heart. And then that laugh that comes from the audience, I always say it's a laugh of relief. Like it's like, oh, I'm not the only one who thinks that. But that sigh comes out as a laugh. And that's what a lot of good comedy is.
You mentioned in the book this idea around structure being important to you, and I hadn't put, so when I first read that, I'm like, well, you could have gotten into design or architecture, lots but math, right? There's lots, and actually comedy and math have a lot in common. But now I'm realizing it's this structure that is also dealing with pain. And that's that the mix that we talk about here in comedy, it's my wife's theory, is pain, recognition, and distance. And that mix you're always sort of playing with is alive in any sort of comedy, from a knock-knock joke to the most absurdist thing you've ever seen. And so I feel like the structure gave you something to hang on while you can both explore it and feel it. And then, you know, when you do it, get that affirmation back, which is interesting because that doesn't always help the comic. We have such a long history, right, of our great comedians getting these amazing laughs and then not being around long.
Yeah, I mean, I've probably done 4 or 5 stand-up sets ever. I've always been much more of a writer and actor than a straight up stand up. But I think in talking to a lot of stand ups, the experience of you go up there alone, you know, standing up, you don't even have a chair to rest in. And then you get that interplay, you get the laugh and you get it back to you, is sort of a more intensive version of what a lot of people get in performance in general. Like I've done a lot of plays, I've done a lot of shows of various kinds, and it's still the same format of like, I'll prepare something, I'll go up there, and then strangers will give me the approval I can't possibly generate for myself. I don't know the psychology of a Belushi or a Chris Farley, how that enters into it. But I think there's an intensity about it. There's a rush that a thrill seeker can naturally gravitate to.
While you were talking, my computer was running out of juice and I realized I didn't look it up. When you saw that blob going, I'm trying to have an intelligent conversation. This guy's like, chest is in the thing. This is in improvisation. You make mistakes work for you. So I just thought I'd call it out. So I just started therapy last year because I had a major loss in my family, and we're going to talk about that with you. But it was interesting reading your experiences of therapy, because they are different than mine. I don't suffer from depression, but I know people I love who do, and their experiences are different. But you write in the book, quote, finding a therapist is a bit like dating. You might have to have some very boring or weird, tense meetings before you find with. You did find people you connected with eventually, but you didn't always stick with them, right?
I wasn't ready to commit to a relationship, to extend the metaphor possibly too far, because I think I had always approached therapy as like, okay, I've got this problem. You know, I'm stressed out all the time lately. And then I need to figure out, oh, it's because of this this situation that I'm in, and the way I'm thinking about it is a little bit wrong. And there may be some echoes from sort of how I was formed, but let's just get through this situation. So I kind of was approaching it as a headache, you know, or a busted fan belt on a car, like go in and get it fixed and then you're done. And the more I learned about trauma and growing up in a household with addiction, the more I realized, okay, I think I've got to get at something really deep. And I also had, the book is sort of a character in the book because I had agreed to write a book. And I thought, well, if someone has hired you to write a book about something, you better learn a lot about it.
Right.
And so I wanted to go to therapy to figure out more of this stuff, which, and a lot of the issues that I had, I figured out better by writing a memoir about them. And which I wouldn't recommend. It's very time consuming. But I think when I finally got to therapy, and I went to somebody in the area, so she was easy to get to. She practiced cognitive behavioral therapy, which I had learned enough about that I'm like, okay, that's the one I want to give my next run at. Mm-hmm. And I went in there ready to collaborate, you know? I mean, in an improv sense, I was finally fully in the scene with my partner. And so I was able to collaborate on this project. I was able to get together with this other person and solve a puzzle together. Mm-hmm. And that's when it really started to click in. And figuring out a lot about my experiences early in life, people will knock therapy saying, oh, you know, your mother didn't love you enough. But also, maybe your mother didn't love you enough.
Right.
You know, which is a thing. It wasn't really my thing, but it happens. And I realized pretty early that it's not about reliving the past. It's not about rehashing the past. It's certainly not about blaming everybody. Everybody's a human being. Everybody's doing the best they can with the tools they have at the time they have them. Mm-hmm. But it's a way of figuring out who you are now and where you go from here. It's very practical in the present day. If you don't know what makes you spiral into a depression, if you don't know why you suddenly get angry at a certain provocation, if you don't know why you keep making these doomed career choices over and over again, whatever it is, figure it out. And then you can avoid that the next time those situations come around. If you want to know why you can't stay in a relationship, go back and trace your history with relationships with a professional. And, you know, then you, like, I mean, again, it's all about the metaphors. Then it's the difference between having a map and knowing where you've been and where you're going versus waking up behind the wheel and trying not to crash.
Yeah, that's a good, when I first started therapy, my wife reminded me before I went to my first session, she goes, Kelly, remember you don't win at therapy. And for me, I was always worried about, because you're a storyteller, I'm a storyteller, that like there's a performance aspect of like, and I don't want to be performative in that session. I want to uncover things. And so it was really important for me to sort of, I don't know, like I'm a talker and I talked less. I really find that in my sessions where it's like I'm trying to find these moments in almost between the words. And then the sort of recognition, because you also talk about trauma and grief, of how deeply that lives inside your body. And that was a huge, we lost our daughter to cancer last year.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And you lost your brother. And as I was reading those chapters, I was like, oh my God, I was tracking so much with what that sort of grief journey is, and the self-blame, and then the recognition of the narcissism around that self-blame, right? I mean, it's like, it is a fucking terrible journey, but one that, I think both of what I was reading in the book, also I felt, which is I've made a ton of discoveries out of this that I am thankful for. I'd give them all up in a minute to have her back in a minute, but the discoveries are true.
Yeah. And I think it's what you say about the talking versus listening. It helps to see that tendency in yourself, and it helps to to start to unpack why you're doing it. I mean, I told my therapist, and I think I even mentioned this in the book, like, I'm going to talk a lot at you, and your job is to stop me, especially when I steer towards a happy ending. Because, you know, it's an ACOA, adult children of alcoholic thing, but it's a thing with a lot of people with my various conditions, to people please. And to say, well, you know, I'm going to tell a story about how bad it's gotten, but then at the end I'll say, but I saw this, you know, I'll elevate some ray of hope. Like, and now I know it's going to be okay. Cause I don't want my therapist to worry about me, which is the whole reason they're there. And so like and I also believe too, we're in a story-driven culture where the movies that we see, the TV shows that we see tend to follow the same hero's journey arc, where in the end things are mostly okay, or, you know, you've learned your lesson and now the problem is behind you, which doesn't fit mental health at all. It's not like that whatsoever. I have to say too, it didn't make it in the book because it came along too late. I interviewed DMC from Run DMC, who's dealt with depression and alcoholism. And he was talking about, just thinking about people pleasing. He was talking about how on one of the last tours with Run DMC, he was suicidal. He was, he had a bunch of things had piled up with alcohol, with finding out he was adopted when he was in his mid 30s. Wow. And he was screwed up and he was suicidal. And he was on the road in Japan and going to a hardware store in Japan to buy rat poison to poison himself. And I said, well, that didn't work. He's like, no, I didn't speak Japanese and the guy didn't speak English. So I'm just yelling in a Japanese hardware store, rat poison, motherfucker. But I said, well, why didn't you just run up to the top of the building and go? And he said, because if I did that, I would die. But Run and Jay would be so mad at me.
And that's unbelievable.
And that's what ultimately kept him alive, was his own screwed up tendencies.
Wow. So I have a son who just graduated college this year. So when he left for college, Trump had just been elected.
Wow.
And I said to him, and you'll see where I'm going with this. I said, listen, when I was going to college, Ronald Reagan had just been named president and we were all sure we were going to die. This was just the thing we knew, that there was no hope. And that you talk about that generationally, that this is our generation. We were convinced.
We were convinced. I was in seventh grade when Reagan was elected, John Lennon was killed, and Mount St. Helens down the road from my house exploded.
God.
And so I was like, well, okay, I get it. We're all going to die. Mm-hmm. And especially in the nuclear war sense. And for people of our generation, that is this trauma that has never been addressed. You know, it we're still alive somehow. We made it. I didn't think I was going to make it to 20, and still we're somehow here. And it's a strange way to have grown up, especially when it just sort of stopped being talked about as much. I compare it in the book to, like, we're in jail and on death row, and then the cell doors swing open and we just have to wander out and figure out society. And so, yeah, I think trauma can come in many forms. And because I always thought, like, going into all this, I always thought, well, trauma, that's when someone close to you dies. Trauma is when you're in a car accident that's really severe. It's a shattering event, but it can be so many things. It's something that is disruptive enough to the brain that it shakes you foundationally and then is just left there. And so if it's just left there, it'll come up in other ways. And unless you get a hold on it and try to go back and evaluate it and give it a good assessment, you don't know what ways it's going to show up.
And I've been doing a ton of reading lately on the kind of racial trauma and generational trauma that exists. And I had no idea this field of science was available to us. But, you know, we look at what's going on in our world and you have a generation after generation just deeply traumatized by what white America has done to black America. And I think that that is a and it just finally feels that white America is waking up to it far too late. We have so much work to do. That trauma is real.
Yeah.
It's
we don't know. I don't think, I mean, I like a lot of cocky young people, I always figured, oh, I understand race in America. And I think we're still, we're finally in this cycle now of realizing how little we knew and how much we don't get it. And if we get a full picture of that, maybe it can improve. But I think you're right of like, you know, just having had no idea what was happening behind the scenes. I've lived in white neighborhoods most of my life, and the role of police was just, oh yeah, those are the guys who sometimes stop you on the highway and give you speeding tickets.
Right, or occasionally bust me for some pot, and then nothing happens.
Right, right. No, I was at a concert in 10th grade. It was a Catch a Rising Star series concert
with all right.
two bands nobody's ever heard of. Paramount Theater in Seattle, $3.50 tickets. Rat and Bon Jovi.
Wow.
Two brand new bands. And my friends and I were smoking pot in the Paramount Theater in Seattle, crouching down in our seats. Cop shines a flashlight on us and says, "Put that away."
Young man.
And that's... That's the best white
person
story I know of.
No. I have that story 100 times because I was a deadhead. And so I was like, yeah, you know, no one was getting arrested.
The whole culture built on that privilege.
Yes, it was all fine. Oh, my God. Well, we're waking up. At least we are now. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But I one of the things that was really funny to me is your experience working at Amazon in the early days.
Yeah. That was something.
I mean, you were like, what number employee? It was like, that was...
I wasn't all that early a number. Like, I wasn't an early enough employee that I could retire.
No. But I mean, still, they weren't Amazon then. They were...
No. It was primarily a bookstore that also sold DVDs and CDs.
Right.
And I was brought in to run an electronic greeting card operation.
Fantastic.
I mean, nobody's experienced to do that. And I was certainly nobody with no experience to do that. And that was an example. My depression reacts very strongly to stress and like impossible deadlines. And so where other people get amped up, I fall to pieces, which is great because I've been in media for 20 years. Smart thinking. And that's when... That experience, it being such a chaos of egos and ambition and corporate nonsense speak combined with pressure, it completely exploded my depression as well as all along let me realize, oh, this is absurd. Like the worst circumstances that I'm in are also very deeply funny when... You know, your French boss is yelling at you about your greeting cards being not clever enough.
Right.
That was an amazing experience. And somehow after doing that for a few years, working there with the greeting cards and then in the toy store, I had an offer to go work in public broadcasting of all things. Mm-hmm. And again, it seems so ridiculous to like give up a spot at the world's fastest growing company that was going to take over the world in favor of public radio.
Well, you know,
I'm like, that's weird enough that I just have to do it.
And that is well before public radio had even a scintilla of hipness to it.
Oh yeah. No, that was very much in the Bob Edwards era of public radio. It was stentorian was the standard at the time.
I'm Facebook friends with Bob Edwards. It's the thing I treasure. I mean, we're not actual friends. Somehow I got in there early.
Man, that's a good thing to hold on to.
I am holding on to it. All right. So we always end the podcast by asking our guest for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, you get nowhere by saying no. And you actually can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
A story where I said the yes and?
You don't have to have said it. The spirit of yes and?
Yeah. Well, where I behaved in that spirit, certainly. Gosh, there's... I mean, I'm tempted to use the story of when my wife and I, 12 years ago, got an offer to just drop everything we knew in Seattle and move to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And we said, yes, and we'll buy a house there and just dive right in. But I think the one I'll use, so it's 1990. I've just graduated from college. I'm on my way to graduate school in acting, and I'm only going to graduate school because I'm don't know what else to do. And a friend of mine had gotten me a job at a summer camp in the San Juan Islands in Washington State. And so I go up there, and all the counselors on the first day of staff training, it's June 17th, 1990, all the counselors in a big ring, we all have to say something we love, share something you love. And everybody's saying, I love working with kids. I love horses. And I just got these great new shoes, these Vasqua hiking shoes. And I was really committed to this idea of owning one pair of shoes for a year. Mm-hmm. So like, you don't have to decide what shoes to wear. You always mm-hmm. wear your shoes. These were great shoes. I still miss them. And so I said, I love my new shoes. And on the other side of the circle, there was a sailing counselor who was there for the summer from Montana. And she said, that's the kind of person I want to marry. Somebody who would make that joke in that situation. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go up and see if he'll help me out with something. So after it's all over, people are breaking up. This cute girl comes up to me, says, hey, I want to teach a song to the camp. And I wonder if you can help me. I'm like, well, what's this? I'm not a musician. She's like, no, I'll teach you the song, but I want you to help me teach it to everybody else. We'll do it as a team. I'm like, okay, what's your name? My name's mm-hmm. Jill. Okay, great. And so she says, the song goes like this. I'm not wearing pants. I'm not wearing pants. I'm not wearing pants. That's the whole song. And I said, I just did a quick calculus. Okay, cute girl, sailing instructor, wants me to do this odd, funny thing. You know, this unexpected comedic moment. Yes. And I'll teach that to the whole camp.
And there's more ands there, too.
There's so many ands. And the song is still sung at that camp today.
Awesome.
Years later. Mm-hmm. And I started dating the girl a year later on June 17th, 1991. We got engaged June 17th, 1994, when O.J. Simpson was driving the Bronco.
Perfect.
Got married June 17th, 1995. And then in a couple of days here, we're going to perform that song at a virtual camp event to mark the 30th anniversary of the introduction of that song and our 25th wedding anniversary, which is next week.
That's perfect. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And that is an awesome yes and story. The book is called The Hilarious World of Depression. John Moe, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Feel young.
feet.
Survive.